I'd like to describe some of the problems that we see in this country now in the area of health, the way people are being adversely affected by poor health conditions, by a often poor health care system. And I think that in describing it, I'd like to focus on a crisis of decision making that I think underlies many of the problems that we see in Washington and that are seen elsewhere in the country. People who are making the decisions, whether they be doctors with respect to patient therapy, owners of factories with respect to the exposure of workers to dangerous chemicals, or the exposure of citizens around the factory to the same dangerous chemicals in smaller concentrations, whether they be dentists or pharmacists, the groups that are doing the decision making are pretty much isolated in most cases from any public input, so that many of the decisions are made by people on behalf of their own self-interest much more than on behalf of the public self-interest. Parallel to what one might call a conflict of interest in decision making, not that the decisions should be made exclusively by the public, but the public should at least have a role in deciding if a new toxic chemical is going to be used in a factory, exposing people in the community and workers to it. People should be involved somewhat in the decision as to whether or not an operation they're going to have is beneficial to them more than it is harmful. We think that coupling with this apparent conflict of interest in excluding consumers from major decisions having to do with health is a very markedly curtailed access to information of all sorts. One of the current activities of many groups in Washington has to do with Federal Freedom of Information Act. This is an act which says that by and large, decisions made by federal agencies and the information upon which the decisions are made are to be made available to the public. One of the greatest abuses of this freedom of information is in the area of pharmaceuticals, where the drug industry tries to impose the notion that all of this information is a trade secret and thereby keep people who honestly want to see the results of drug testing and so forth from seeing it. So the decision making has two unfortunate components. The decisions are largely made by perpetrators, owners, operators, rather than by the victims of these decisions. And the victims have very limited access to information that they should have in order to make a better decision. The two are tied up, I think, very closely, because the number one argument that is always raised against consumers being involved in decision making is, how do they know? You know, they didn't go to medical school, they don't know how to do an operation, they aren't a biochemist and so forth. And with respect to technical kind of information, some of these criticisms are correct. But at the same time as consumers are being criticized for not being capable of participating in decision making, they are being prevented from getting any kind of information that could make them more capable. So that sort of vicious circle, I think, needs to end, and in many ways is beginning to end. With respect to health, whether it be health care or adverse effects on people's health, can break down people who are making decisions into two major groups: industries, those who run the industries, and the professional groups. The industries produce goods, which in the case of the chemical industry have very adverse effects on people's health in the plant and outside. The drug industry, the same. And the people who offer or deliver or sell services, whether they be dentists, doctors, pharmacists, and the like. If you look at the way the industries are run, and the industry with which we are most familiar is the chemical industry, including the pharmaceutical industry, but a lot of work that our group has done has been helping workers in local unions, particularly in the chemical industry, be able to gain enough information so they can do something about very adverse working conditions. they are excluded from the decision-making process. And I'd like to give a couple of very specific recent examples of the gross levels to which this exclusion goes. A local chemical company, a union of a local chemical company, about a year and a half ago, Ciba Geigy, which makes pharmaceuticals, but this particular plant happened to be an agricultural products division making pesticides and other agricultural chemicals, fertilizers. The workers in this plant, many of whom had suffered undelineated disease out of proportion to their age and numbers, became concerned with the passage of a federal law in 1971, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, became concerned about the fact that they didn't have any means of getting a handle on their exposure on the job. And so they asked the company for a list of the chemicals that they were working with. And the company said, you don't have a right to have this information. And they contested this, and finally, this got to the level of a federal arbitration judge. But the sole issue was, does a worker have a right to know the names of chemicals in the workplace? It seems like, you know, a ridiculously simple kind of issue, and anyone who even remotely believes in human rights, worker rights, would think that it would be automatically granted. But it wasn't granted, and it had to be taken through level after level of arbitration and grievance and so forth. And finally, after probably thousands of hours of expenditure of a large number of people's time, the issue was won in favor of the workers. And the decision was that, yes, workers do have a right to know the name of chemicals that they work with, a right which is obviously very prerequisite to finding out whether or not any of the chemicals are harmful. Another example of the indifference on the part of industries for workers, and we've seen other evidences in the past of the indifference on the part of industry in terms of environmental issues. Another chemical company, workers exposed to benzene. Benzene is very commonly used as a solvent, as a starting material for a number of other processes, and benzene has been very well documented to cause bone marrow depression, manifested by low white count, by anemia, in some cases by pancytopenia, and there are a large number of cases in the medical literature of acute leukemia occurring 5 or 10 times higher incidence in workers in plants where they're exposed to benzene. Well, the issue in this plant was not whether or not the workers had a right to their names of chemicals they were working with, although the company sort of thought they didn't, but the workers had gotten a hold of the information. So the issue was, does the worker have the right to have a doctor of his or her choosing look at the medical records that the company has accumulated that show whether or not being exposed to benzene has had any adverse effects on the person's health? And the answer by the company was no. The worker does not have the right to choose a doctor of his or her choice and have the medical records forwarded from the company doctor and the company to this other doctor. This is a right which is considered part of medical practice for most people in this country, but apparently workers are not looked upon as first-class human beings, and they were excluded to this right. Same series of grievances, arguments went about, and just 2 weeks ago in Pittsburgh, we were involved with, again, an arbitration before a federal judge on whether the workers have a right to see whether or not they've become anemic, how anemic they've become, and so forth, to have a doctor see it. We've been involved with a number of unions on similar kinds of issues having to do with industrial lead poisoning, and the critical element for the workers even beginning to do anything about being poisoned in the workplace is finding out what chemicals are there, seeing or getting someone of their choosing to see the medical records, and then using the contract as a weapon, using striking as a weapon, trying to negotiate changes. In the process of doing this, we've worked with two unions that were involved with industrial lead poisoning, where a significant proportion of the workers were anemic, and as a result of the workers being given a report by our group of how many were getting lead poisoning, they were able to change significantly the working conditions in the plant. So that in this case, workers in a plant exposed to chemicals are excluded from decision-making often as to whether the chemical is having an adverse effect, or even more basically, whether a new chemical known to be toxic should be used, even though it costs a penny less than another non-toxic chemical. These decisions are made 1, 2, 3 blocks or miles away by the executives of the corporation, who themselves make every effort not to be exposed to these chemicals by distance in addition to ventilation precautions. The same is true in another sense about decision making on the part of people who receive professional health services. We have raised repeatedly the issue of unnecessary surgery, over-prescribing of drugs, and so forth, and human experimentation. But critical to all of these issues is, again, the fact that the person who is victimized in many cases, or who is the at least intended recipient of the professional services or goods in the case of drugs as a consequence of professional services, people are not given what one could call informed consent. Informed consent is something that is more traditionally thought of in connection with a surgical procedure. But in a sense, an informed consent should be a part of any kind of therapeutic decision by anyone who's involved in health or in law, for that matter. Patients rarely have any idea what their diagnosis is. They don't feel it's their right to ask, what is the name of the disease that you have decided I have, let alone what basis did you use to arrive at it. Medical records are kept in abysmally sloppy and illegible and non-scientific fashion. Nor, having made a decision as to what the diagnosis is, does the patient have any notion as to what the benefits and risks and possible consequences of some of the therapies are. We have recently been very much involved in efforts to improve the informed consent of women with respect to sterilization. This all generated from the unfortunate case of two, 11 and 13-year-old children in the South who were sterilized, one of whom probably turns out not to be retarded, although that was the justification for doing it. No informed consent, no one knew what was going on. Well, there are a small number of people in this country who are underage and mentally retarded for whom extra precautions need to be used for informed consent. But most people getting sterilized in this country are neither underage nor mentally retarded, but with respect to the information that they should have in order to make the decision, they are certainly retarded from getting the information. People in many university centers estimate that as many as a quarter or a third of all hysterectomies are done without any justification at all, and the usual trick is the doctor telling the woman that, well, you probably don't want to have any more kids, and in addition to that, you have a little medical problem, might as well take care of that at the same time. They obscure a non-therapeutic reason for sterilization, namely just to stop having children, with a contrived or often contrived medical reason, which may not be contrived in terms of its existence, but is often contrived in terms of whether its existence really indicates the need for doing a hysterectomy or other form of sterilization. So that, again, the decision-making process is totally taken out of the hands of people who are affected by it. And again, we are not advocating that women learn how to do hysterectomies or that women go to medical school. But what is being advocated is that women ask, as they are in many places, more and more questions when people say, hey, we think you should have a hysterectomy. A recent appalling example of how cavalier obstetricians and gynecologists are took place at the National Convention of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology 2 years ago. And at that time, so-called elective sterilization for non-medical reasons was beginning to increase more and more, so that in one major teaching center at UCLA, there was a sevenfold increase in hysterectomies over the last 2 years prior to that time. What was going on is that doctors who previously hid behind medical reasons were coming out and saying, we don't need to pretend that we're doing it for medical reasons, we'll just do it because we think that there should be population control and so forth and so on. Well, in order to give publicity to this issue and allegedly resolve it, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology decided to have a debate, and it was called the Great Debate, and they taped this debate, and I got a copy of the debate. And it went something like this. There were three people speaking in favor of elective sterilization. Hysterectomy was the specific topic. Hysterectomy by elective sterilization as a means of elective hysterectomy as a means of sterilization. So three people spoke in favor of it, three people spoke against. And one of the main remarks, most notable remarks in favor of it, was by someone from the nearby Mayo Clinic, who said that, "I hope that obstetricians and gynecologists have become mature enough so that when their patients have reached the age of 40 and have decided that they don't want any more children, that they can call up their friendly obstetrician and gynecologist and schedule their birthday hysterectomy." And this drew great guffaws and laughter from the audience there. But when all was said and done, they carted out an applause meter, which is a very professional way of deciding issues, and subjected the two sides of the debate to an applause meter. And both in terms of, well, this actually happened, both in terms of intensity and duration of applause, although there were a few selected people who could be heard over the tape recorder applauding particularly long and loud, the side pro won. Well, I think I'm all in favor of democracy, even in the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. But the only reason I mention this is that it really bespeaks the very casual and cavalier attitude that obstetricians and gynecologists have about sterilizing other people. And a recent article just appeared about 3 months ago on the sterilization or family control practices of obstetricians and gynecologists themselves. And although they are recommending with increasing ardor and frequency sterilization, surgical sterilization for other people, their own wives don't use it quite as frequently as they prescribe it. So that there's a bit of a contradiction in that. What can we do about all of this? There are two levels of action for anything, I suppose, whether it's in the health area or not in the health area, and these are individual action and action by the government. And neither as a sole means works, despite the assertions to the contrary by respectively anarchists or centralized socialists, depending on whether you believe in individual action or total government action. But I think that a combination of both approaches has somewhat characterized at least the efforts that we have made, whether it be in occupational health, where we've worked with local unions at the same time as we have tried to strengthen the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Act, whether it be in the area of health care delivery, where we have worked with local citizens groups at the same time as we have tried to improve HEW's regulation of health care, limited as though it may be, or in the case of pesticides, drugs, consumer products, the same thing. People at an individual level need to be equipped with a certain amount of information so they can make an intelligent decision to buy something or not to buy it, which one to buy or not at all, and in the case of being a patient, whether or not there is adequate justification for certain decisions that have been heaped upon them. Certain questions can be asked, such as I suggested before, having to do with what's wrong with me, why are you giving me this drug or operation. So that we work with local groups, we do local pilot projects, such as a recent doctor's directory, which we just finished a month or so ago, but we also believe in a federal kind of effort. Why is there any need for a federal effort? Why is there Washington? Why are there regulatory agencies in Washington that are trying to improve things in pharmaceuticals and household products and doctors and so forth? Well, the reason is, getting back to the original statement, the reason is that the decision making left to its own devices, whether at an industrial level, in the case of plants, factories, chemical companies, drug companies, or in the case of professional groups, just hasn't worked out. These groups have not been accountable. And I needn't recite all the disasters that have resulted from the lack of accountability, but refer any of you to state laws regarding pharmacy, medicine, dentistry. They are pure, unadulterated self-interest laws, and to the practices of the industries, which have much more concern about short-term goals, such as their profits and so forth, than they do about the long-term societal impact of their blowing stuff out into the air and killing off workers. There's a chemical company up in Buffalo in which there are 100 workers who've gotten bladder cancer. 100 workers have gotten bladder cancer from exposure to benzidine and beta-naphthalamine. And the company really did a little bit about it as a result of state inspections, but only by virtue of a lawsuit that we and some chemical workers brought last year. Our company is starting to clean up cancer-causing chemicals, which are, you know, have caused the death of thousands of workers in this country. So that, left to their own devices, the industry doesn't seem to be terribly interested in these long-term things. A worker doesn't get bladder cancer until 20 years after they start working with the chemical. And by then, they may not even be working in the company anymore, so that there's even less reason for the company to be concerned. So that the abdication of responsibility, or the lack of accountability, put in more modern terms, of professional groups or industry, is really the cause of there being an increasing amount of effort at a federal or state or local level to bring into some kind of control what's going on. Another obvious reason is, in the case of pharmaceuticals or health services, the government is paying a much larger share than it used to of the bill, and for that reason alone, so-called cost reasons, they become interested. So that the goal, in one sense, of what we are doing in Washington with our group, and what many other public interest groups are doing at a state level in health or in other areas, is to increase the role of the individual consumer in decision making. And that's just not a marketplace decision making, allowing them to buy better goods, but also allowing them to live in a cleaner place or work in a cleaner place. What is the role of pharmacy in this whole process? Now, I'll just spend a few minutes talking about that, and I'd really be interested in spending the rest of the time listening to what you have to say and answering questions that you may have. There's this thing called preventive medicine, which is a fairly new department in some universities, and preventive medicine owed most of its origins, as did public health, to cleaning up infectious diseases. And so they got immunizations going and started studying epidemics and so forth and so on. Is there such a thing as preventive pharmacy? Well, as Dr. Weaver said at the beginning, the role of pharmacies, schools of pharmacies, changed significantly in the last while from a product orientation, which implies dispensing of goods and services, to the beginnings of a patient orientation, which has to do with the implications of the goods and services that are dispensed. The idea of academic pharmacy has become very popular, so that people are talking about making rounds in hospitals with doctors and looking at drug interactions and so forth, and I'm glad to see this happen. Hopefully it will happen, fully aware of all the lessons to be learned from how this happened some time ago in medicine and what went wrong with it happening. What went wrong in medicine, in a few sentences from my humble perspective, is that the AMA, which at one time was a much better organization than it is now, with the advent of academic medicine, pretty much divided in its ranks, and many of the academicians left the AMA, either actually or functionally, and became involved with teaching medical students and so-called academic medicine, and left the AMA sort of crippled by the absence of their progressive thoughts. And I certainly hope that as academic pharmacy becomes more and more a part of teaching of pharmacy and the practice of pharmacy, that the same thing doesn't happen, that the less progressive elements in pharmacy are not left to their own devices to go saying and doing whatever they want, which may or may not be in the public interest. A recent example of this, which we had a discussion about just before I started talking, has to do with the government's recently announced policy with respect to purchasing generic drugs. For 2 years, a memo has been lying and floating around HEW that says that federally financed or HEW financed healthcare programs should not be buying the most expensive drugs, as they frequently are, but should be buying the lowest price quality drugs. Hence, at long last, when forced to it by a number of groups and individuals, when no further delay could have been in countenance, Secretary Weinberger announced last December 19th, I believe, that they would implement such a policy. The Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, which represents the large drug manufacturers, has been trying every way they could to get people on the bandwagon against this, because, of course, their drugs, the highest quality brand name drugs, are much better than generic drugs. They seem to have forgotten that in the last few years, they themselves have become one of the major dispensers of generic drugs, often made by some of the same small companies that they attack when they sell the same generic drugs under their own label. But when they sell them under the label of the Pfizer and Merck, they are the good kind of generic drugs. Well, they omit that kind of argument. But they've been running two-page ads in the medical journals in the last 6 months or so, where an increasing list of organizations that opposes this concept of government purchasing generic drugs has been listed: the American Medical Association, Board of Trustees, and a whole host of other organizations, including retail druggists and the like. And I was very disturbed to see that at a recent tropical meeting in the last month or so, January 10th, I believe, the American Association of Colleges of Pharmacy joined the ranks and voted with a resolution that attacked the concept of the government buying the lowest price quality drugs. As students of pharmacy, you really should demand some kind of explanation for this, although I'm told that the decision was not exactly made in the most informed consent way, that it was a hurried decision that many people who went to the meeting didn't know that it was going to come up as an issue. Nevertheless, your trade association, your professional association, has voted with the industry, essentially, on an issue that's critical because it involves saving of an extraordinary amount of tax money, which you are paying for, and it involves putting to rest old antiquated concepts that are completely repudiated if only because the major manufacturers who keep bad-mouthing the generics themselves are doing it, except that, as I said before, it's good when they do it, even though it's someone else's drugs that they're selling. Well, I mention this simply as an example of preventive pharmacy, whatever that is. This is preventing people from wasting an extraordinary amount of money. In this case, it's preventing everyone from wasting a lot of money on unnecessarily expensive drugs when much better or much less expensive, equally effective drugs are available. I think that it goes beyond just taking stands on federal issues such as this, or taking the wrong stand, or what I would consider the wrong stand on a federal issue like this. It goes beyond making rounds in the hospital. It goes to one of the most serious consequences of the product which pharmacists have always delivered and focused on, the drugs, adverse drug reactions. There have been excellent articles on adverse drug reactions in the Journal of American Pharmaceutical Association, to a lesser extent in the medical literature. But adverse drug reactions are something that preventive pharmacy could cut down on significantly. There is a recent experiment conducted out on the West Coast wherein a pharmacist started reviewing the purchasing practices, prescribing practices, and so forth of patients in a nursing home, and found that they were able to save something like 80% of the costs of drugs, if you included not only the purchase costs, but also the costs of hospitalizations due to adverse drug reactions and so forth. So here you have a pharmacist not dishing out products, but intervening in what is a terribly irrational process called prescribing drugs, which doctors do, ignorant of many of the important principles which should underlie prescribing, but very aware of the most recent message by the latest detail man to visit them. I think that to the extent that adverse reactions are attributable in many ways to drugs that should never have been given in the first place, to say nothing of misprescribing and overdosing and misdosing and drug interactions for drugs that should have been prescribed in the first place, there is a very significant role for the pharmacist to play at this point in time, very clearly to act as a countervailing force to the doctor. In recent testimony before the Senate hearings on drugs, we recommended that all promotion of prescription drugs should be stopped entirely to doctors. The only information that should be given out by the companies are information having to do with price of drugs, which doctors are almost totally unaware of now, and published studies having to do with the safety and efficacy of the drug. And it's difficult to imagine why a doctor should be concerned about anything other than what a drug costs the patient, to the extent the two drugs of equal efficacy and safety are differing by fivefold in cost, and whether the drug works or not, and if it's safe, or how safe it is, what the adverse reactions are, what interactions it has. Well, these are the last factors that are considered by many doctors in prescribing drugs, to wit, the extraordinary overuse of antibiotics for conditions that never have been shown to respond to antibiotics, tranquilizers for conditions that have more to do with normal stress than to do with any serious kind of mental impairment and the like. What role is pharmacy going to take in becoming preventive pharmacy? In other words, preventing overprescription of drugs and all the other disastrous doctor-originated things with the help of the drug industry, doctor-originated things which kill off a large number of people. I don't know the answer, and I'd certainly like to hear from some of you what your thoughts are about this and the way in which some of these things are incorporated not only into your academic practice as you are learning in school, but into what you do after school. I mean, are there people who don't work in drugstores, who don't work in hospitals, who are working in the area of educating doctors? There's such an experiment going on at the Virginia Commonwealth Pharmacy School, I believe now. They have been sending some students out to doctor's offices to replace the drug detail man, or they won't say to replace it because that's too strong language, but they say to augment the drug detail man. We have argued that the idea of a drug detail man whose income is directly proportional in many ways to the amount of drugs he sells, the idea of such a person giving out purely objective information is just absolutely impossible. However, what is learned from the drug detail man experience, I think, is that it's very helpful to have people going into doctors' offices. And I think that in the future, more and more efforts will be made towards providing teams of pharmacists and doctors to go into doctors' offices and talk with them about what's the best drug to use for someone that has an upset stomach and so forth, rather than having them listen to 10 messages about antibiotics that probably should never be used in 9 out of 10 cases, and which are 5 times more expensive when used than something that is equally effective. But as I said, I'd be glad in hearing your reaction to these kinds of thoughts. And as I've mentioned in correspondence with people at this school, we, for the first time, are going to have a pharmacy student this summer working with us. We have not yet selected the student out. And if any of you, undergraduate or graduate, are interested in working in what we can call preventive pharmacy, be glad to talk with you afterwards or have you write to us. It's the Health Research Group, 2000 P Street in Washington. to summarize, then, I think there's a great role for pharmacists in the future in the other than product orientation, as has already been alluded to. And I think that rather than become an adversary to the doctor, which is what people say when you say, well, shouldn't, why don't pharmacists get empowered with looking at what is being diagnosed, not just what's being prescribed, so they can look at a prescription and decide whether or not the prescription that's been written has anything to do with the disease that allegedly exists. And when you mention this, they say, well, we don't want to get on the outs with the doctors, and we don't want to antagonize the doctors, and we don't want to become adversaries to the doctors. And whereas in the long run, nobody hopes that the adversary relationship is all that exists. Right now, we are really in a serious crisis having to do with too much pushing of medicines by doctors under the influence of a tremendous amount of promotion. The billion-dollar a year figure has really never been refuted, except that it's getting slightly larger now. $1 billion spent per year in various forms of promotion of prescription drugs. So that for the present, it may be necessary to become an adversary to the pharmaceutical manufacturers, and certainly to become an adversary to some doctors who think that it's necessary to give pills out to everyone regardless of what's wrong with them. Another area where pharmacists can become involved, which has nothing to do with at least the practicing physician, has to do with over-the-counter drugs. And this is one thing that we're considering having a student work on this summer. As you know, there's been a massive initiation of reviewing over-the-counter drugs, something that hasn't really ever been done before, to look at such basic questions as, do they work or not, which is supposedly a legal requirement under the 1962 drug law, and are they safe relative to the benefits that accrue on people from using them. I think there's a tremendous role for pharmacists here. The literature that I read in the trade magazines that ask the question of pharmacists, what would you prescribe if someone came into you and said, hey, I have an upset stomach, presents in many ways a far more rational set of decisions being made than in some cases are made by doctors, and certainly more rational than the decisions that consumers make as a result of the television promotion of over-the-counter drugs. We've been very much involved with Alka-Seltzer for the last year and a half, trying to end its use as an antacid. As I hope most of you know, Alka-Seltzer has a large slug of aspirin in it, and if there's any group of people who should not be taking aspirin, it's people with gastrointestinal symptoms. And yet, that's been the main reason that Alka-Seltzer has been used. And we've been involved in a whole series of struggles with the Food and Drug Administration and with Miles Laboratories because they have somehow wanted to keep it on the market as an antacid, somehow suspecting that if it's used only as a painkiller, that it won't be as popular at 20 times the cost of aspirin as it is right now. And the compromise position that was evolved by this antacid advisory committee was, it's not rational to prescribe Alka-Seltzer as an antacid alone, because people who take it for gastrointestinal symptoms might have an ulcer and so forth, and it might aggravate. But if you have a headache, then it's all right. And if you look at the recent change in Alka-Seltzer ads, you see that reflected. They say, if you have a headache and symptoms of gastrointestinal, then it's all right to take Alka-Seltzer. Well, on the basis of logic, without knowing anything about medicine or pharmacy, that does not seem to make too much sense. And we will surely be involved in a lawsuit, possibly, if our position, which is not to allow it to be used as an antacid, is not adopted. We were involved in a formal hearing before the Food and Drug Commissioner over this issue. The main attorney for the Food and Drug Administration, the general counsel for the Food and Drug Administration, who had significant input into changing what was initially a decision by the advisory committee not to allow it to be used as an antacid, to changing this decision to the present irrational one. This attorney used to be the lawyer for Miles Laboratories. Such is the conflict of interest in Washington and elsewhere. So I think in addition to prescription drugs, that there's a major role that can be played more and more by pharmacists in again, countervailing the very insidious forces of television promotion that promote, in many cases, the worst and most expensive drugs rather than ones that are the most benefit. Miles Laboratory spends something like $30 or more million a year promoting Alka-Seltzer, largely on television. Well, I'll close now going back to the original theme that if you think that patients should be involved more in decision-making, since you are all patients in addition to being pharmacists, we'd be interested in having you work with us, be interested in helping out local programs here. We're going to meet this afternoon with the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, which I understand has already initiated some programs with people in the School of Pharmacy. This is very, very critical. More so than in almost any area, many things having to do with healthcare delivery need to be regulated, need to have accountability at a local level, and we're certainly glad to help develop local projects, work with them, in addition to doing things in Washington. Thank you.